I'd like to welcome everybody. This is the first time I've attended one of these programs myself. So I was waiting for someone to tell me what's going on. But of course, the notion of being a good neighbor is one that's found throughout world religions. In the New Testament, it said that Jesus summarized many different commandments by saying that one should love one's neighbor as oneself and love God with all one's heart. So, the... 5 minutes. Till 5 o'clock. Oh my God, people are going to panic if they know I'm going to go until 5. So, we have a spiritual community here, and I don't myself live here. I'm actually living in Gainesville right now because I came to teach a few courses at the university, teaching the history of Indian religions. But I think in the course I'm teaching right now at the university, we go over several different religions, actually, and including Buddhism, Hinduism, and Christianity and Judaism and Islam also came to India and still exist there. So, in a sense, it's a course on world religions. And basically in all religions that have survived historically, that sort of made the cut, you know, were good enough to survive, there is a strong notion that all of us, whatever our material position might be, whatever our financial or political or social position may be, whatever kind of body we're in, but all of us are somehow neighbors. All of us are somehow coming from the same source, and that although human society is divided up, you could say genealogically or biologically, into many different families, clans, communities, countries, and so on, that ultimately everyone really is just one family. This is this view of a not merely a global village, but actually a global family, is especially prominent in theistic traditions, traditions that accept in some way or other that there is a God who is something like a supreme parent, and that all of us are somehow part of that, are coming from that supreme parent. So, in practice, there's an interesting tension that you can observe in world religions, I mean, basically in all world religions, because on the one hand, a tension occurs and things are kind of pulling in different directions. You get attention, and so, on the one hand, many religions aspire to a type of universal fraternity, universal friendship, the idea of peace on earth, goodwill toward men, and what about the women? We have to have goodwill toward women, I guess, also the women. So religions typically have this philosophy, this idea that we should have goodwill toward everyone, that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. And at the same time, it's very typical that religion believes that it has a unique or special message, and that a particular religious community is a unique or special community, and therefore there's also this sense of maintaining one's own distinct identity. And there's the tension, in a sense. I avoided the pseudo-learned cliché, there's the love from Shakespeare. So the idea is that on the one hand, a community has to maintain its own identity, which inevitably involves boundaries. For example, you live in a house or an apartment, and there are boundaries. I mean, there's a property line, so there are walls in your house, so that you may be the best neighbor in the world, but there's your property and your neighbor's property. And as they say, good fences make good boundaries. So this tension of, on the one hand, trying to be a good neighbor, trying to really embrace everyone as part of God, and at the same time, trying to maintain your own boundaries, trying to maintain the distinctness or the uniqueness of your community, of your group. It's an interesting situation. And what we found is that, I hate to be so academic, but what you see is what you get. So, I mean, in a sense, I think you could say philosophically, we dare speak philosophy in the 21st century, that it depends to some extent, the ability to maintain your own distinct identity as a special spiritual religious community, whatever your religion may be. At the same time, really open yourself to other people. I think to some extent it depends upon one's conception of God. Like if someone sees God as extremely jealous to the point almost of psychosis, where, I mean, if you think of crimes of passion, if you think of crimes of passion like, you know, you done me wrong, you know, you betrayed me, and therefore I'm going to kill you. You know, to a crime of passion because you left me, you walked out the door. And I'm not going to do a whole country song here for you, but this is a, don't get your hopes up. So, but that's a very common theme. That's a, you know, it's a very common theme in country songs and blues and frankly in newspapers. It's a very common theme, crimes of passion, where people are so unhealthy emotionally that if someone turns them down or someone walks out on them, they become violent. And in our culture, some people have a notion of God like that, where God is, frankly, almost like a serial torturer, in the sense that God will torture you if you commit not even like physical crimes, but actually mental crimes. Mental crimes. In other words, if you don't believe a particular doctrine, whether it's mine or you, if I don't believe a particular doctrine, then God will torture me forever. And the idea of a supreme deity that tortures his own children forever for mental crimes, I think it's troublesome. I think it's problematic and not really consistent with the notion of God as an infinitely merciful and even sane being. Because, I mean, we wouldn't really think highly of a father or mother that tortured their children because the children didn't agree with the parents. I mean, we probably wouldn't look very favorably on those parents. So in the same way, how should I put it? I think the extent that we have a reasonable concept of God, the extent to which we have a concept that God is emotionally healthy, in addition to being all-powerful, that we can still hold very firmly to our own views, whatever our religion may be. We can still have strong conviction that a particular religious path is the best or is the one for me. But without having a wild, violent notion of what God does to people that disagree with me. And so, because after all, anyone that's a parent, I'm sure some people here are parents, anyone that's a parent knows that, you know, your children never really completely agree with you. Everyone that's ever raised a child knows what a pleasant surprise it is when your child agrees with you on something. And yet, parents don't give up on their children. Patience is a virtue. Patience is a virtue. And God, in our view, possesses all virtues infinitely. And so therefore, since patience is a virtue, God is infinitely patient. And being infinitely patient, it doesn't... How should I say it? Being infinitely patient, God will give us infinite time to come to our senses. In the meantime, it doesn't mean that I can misbehave and with impunity, that, you know, I can just misbehave and nothing's going to happen. Good parents, loving parents, because this analogy of God as a parent, as a father, or as a mother, the analogy, you know, God or Goddess, somehow the Supreme is apparent, is widespread. It's actually found throughout the world. It's something which human beings gravitate to. If you study the history of human culture, you'll find that human beings gravitate to this understanding. And so, since we are drawing analogies with human relationships, such as parent to child, then I think it's reasonable, even though we may say that God is greater than us and all that, I still think it's reasonable and even necessary that we apply something of what we know about life in this world, that we apply that in our attempt to understand what God might be like. And so, John Stuart Mill, an English philosopher, among the outrageous things, he also said something which I agree with. He said many things, some of them are more interesting than others. But one thing John Stuart Mill said is that I cannot worship a God who is morally inferior to human beings, to a good human being. And so if we look at a good father, a good mother, good parents sometimes punish their children, but only to the extent necessary to bring about some significant good for the child. It's just like you take your child to get an inoculation. I mean, parents don't, good parents don't whimsically just bring their children to get shots just for the fun of it, just for the fun of seeing your kid get a shot. Because inoculation is, you know, somewhat uncomfortable. Therefore, parents subject their children to certain types of inconvenience or even pain only when it's necessary to bring about significant good. After all, what would be the use of, I mean, good parents don't punish their children just because the parents want to vent their anger. That's not a good reason to punish a child. Rather, the punishment should be for the good of the child. And it should simply be the punishment necessary, minimum necessary, to bring about a necessary good. So, in response to our behavior, in response to the choices we make, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that a wise and loving God would sometimes reward us and sometimes punish us to the extent necessary to bring about a significant good for us. But if there is permanent punishment, if the punishment goes on forever, then the motive cannot be to help the child. And since we're all children of God, why would a parent punish a child without the intention of actually... Why would a good parent punish a child without the intention of helping the child? I mean, why else would you punish a child if not to help the child? And so, therefore, if God punishes us in some way, and all of us have, you know, we have bumps in the road, it must be to bring about our good. And if it's to bring about our good, it must mean that there's some kind of plan to ultimately redeem every one of us, however long it takes. From the point of view of eternity, one lifetime is a very, it's an infinitesimal amount of time. In the context of eternity, of one human lifetime is almost nothing. An infinitely patient God would be willing to invest much more, infinitely more, than a single lifetime to bring about our ultimate salvation. So there are certain views that we hold externally for those of us who are, you know, visiting us here. Hope someone's visiting. Please, someone visit us. So, for those who are visiting, some things are externally a bit exotic. I mean, even to me, and I've been doing this almost 40 years. So, because this great wisdom came from a different part of the world, and if you study the history of religions, successful spiritual traditions migrate, they tend to spread, and inevitably when a spiritual tradition spreads, it goes into areas where there are different cultures, different ethnicities. People do things differently, they dress and cook in different ways. And there's a certain, if you study the history of religious migration, just the history of, for example, if you look in America, if you look at place names, with the names of towns and cities in America, you can see they often reflect the culture of the people that settled those areas. So in certain parts of the country where the French settled, you find French names like Des Moines, Iowa, right, or Fond du Lac, Lake Bottom. I guess that's Wisconsin or something. Des Moines, Iowa means the monks. I don't know how many monks they still have there in this city, but... And there are German names, and where Germans settled, and English names where English people settled. So similarly, when religions, if you study the spread of Christianity, or Buddhism, or Hinduism, whatever, if you just study the spread, the migration, the traveling of spiritual traditions from one geographic location to another, these traditions don't travel simply as like pure, disembodied, disencultured philosophies or theologies. It tends to be a whole culture that spreads, so that a certain way of dressing, a certain way of cooking, a certain type of architecture, certain style of music, a certain way of performing wedding ceremonies, or whatever. And then there's a period in which it's almost like two rivers merging. And after a while, the two rivers merge. So, for example, Christians in this country no longer dress like Palestinians of 2,000 years ago. Although there was a time when they did dress like that because they were Palestinians 2,000 years ago. But now in America, people dress differently. So, here we are on this farm, and for those of us who are, those are, not those of us, actually for those of us who are visiting, I'm visiting also. I'm just someone off the street that put these ropes on me and put me on the seat. I have a call into my lawyer. Anyway, so basically what we're trying to do here is to present the wisdom that we've received, which we find, I know I find, is simply reasonable. It's simply reasonable. One very powerful fact about South Asia, and most of South Asia is today called India. But that's not what it used to be called. And so if you study the very ancient culture of that part of the world, the very ancient culture of South Asia, one of the most remarkable, you could say one of the most precocious facts about it, is that as far back as you can go, the earliest literature, going back many thousands of years, there was actually freedom of religion. There was actually freedom of religion. And there's also, by the way, if you're interested, freedom of speech. You can look at political regimes thousands of years ago, in ancient texts like the Mahabharata, and there was actually freedom of speech. You could go out into the street and criticize the government, the king, and no one was going to cut your head off. So I think that's quite interesting that thousands of years ago there was freedom of religion, freedom of speech. Most of the freedoms we have today existed actually in very ancient India. So, ultimately, historically, I think the freedom which India has enjoyed from almost all of its history, the freedom of religion, produced, well, it was very healthy. It was very healthy because it allowed the people there to freely, according to their conscience, and according to their practical experiences, to cultivate advanced spiritual systems. When you, just to give one simple example from history, which is not meant to offend anyone, but if you study the history of Christianity, there's a very interesting period, the first 100 years or 200 years after Jesus, where the Jesus movements, there were many of them, were not formally affiliated with any political regime, with any military regime. And there was basically there was a certain freedom, because in the Roman Empire in general, it was kind of like this New Age empire, in the sense that it was eclectic, diverse, and there was freedom of religion to a great extent in the Roman Empire. And as a result of that, as a result of two facts, number one, that there was freedom in the Roman Empire, and number two, that Jesus inspired many different people in different parts of the world, the result was that there were many different interpretations and different people were inspired in different ways. And so there were... The result was that there was a... there were many different communities, whether in Upper Egypt, which is Lower Egypt. Upper in the sense the land gets higher. If you go south in Egypt, it gets hilly and mountainous, and so that's Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt is Lower Egypt. And so there were Gnostic communities who were dedicated to Jesus. There were philosophers like Origen who believed in reincarnation, karma, and so on, who was actually one of the early bishops in the Christian community. So it was actually a diverse community. It was actually, and there were many different philosophical, theological trends. That all ended, the fun ended in the 4th century of this era, when powerful Christian groups entered into a formal alliance with the Roman Empire. And at that time, people were basically forced militarily, physically coerced into adopting a particular theology, to accepting certain texts as authoritative and so on. And that was really the end of the... Well, basically, that freedom was curtailed for about approximately 1,200 years. 1,100 or 1,200 years until the Protestant Reformation, a time in which Europe was again divided and there was again a type of freedom to come up with, although you know people were often killed for kind of the wrong idea in the wrong place at the wrong time, but still, in general, the trend was toward freedom. So in India, we have a situation where there was always this freedom, and so there's a tremendous development, often based on practical experience, consciousness, a tremendous development of religious diversity. So basically, that's the intention, to present a reasonable concept which also is consistent with available experience. So that, because as we see today in the present situation in the world, irrational religion or religion which divorces itself from reason can be very dangerous. Because if someone believes they have the power of God behind them, and that they have no requirement, no responsibility to be reasonable, that can be a very explosive, dangerous combination. Anyway, so I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'm a guest myself. You don't live out here. And so, any questions on these points? So anyway, anything I can help you with. Yes. We did talk about it, but I can say more. The basic notion I would say is that the world as we experience it, the world as we experience it, nature, including ourselves, since we're part of nature, actually does give us important information about the nature of God. If I can throw in one more thing, one more foreign idea here, I'll get back to it. That there was a popular thing to say during the Renaissance in Europe, that actually God has given us two books. One is the Bible, the other is the book of nature. And so if the extent to which we accept that the world is a real world that can actually teach us something, then if we study ourselves, we are part of nature and we find that we are persons. And so our personal identity also tells us something about the nature of God. And the idea being that if one uses one's God-given intelligence, one can ask questions such as, why am I a person? Why do I exist as a person? Why do I exist in a personal world? And what does this tell me about the nature of the source of my existence? And so, the conviction then is that there is a personal God. And that personal existence is... It's really the greatest blessing to be a free individual, to be a person, because the possibilities, the potentialities are actually infinite. There's no end to how far we can develop ourselves within the context of a creation in which the source of our existence is infinite personal consciousness, infinite personal being. And so, and then as I alluded to also, analogously, that our personal existence is actually eternal. In other words, it's not that at a certain point we become enlightened in a particular way and repudiate our own existence. So the purpose of philosophy, the purpose of spirituality, of meditation, is not to self-destruct. It's not to destroy oneself. It's not to obliterate oneself as a free, thinking, conscious, loving individual. But actually the purpose of spirituality is to develop oneself, become a greater person, a wiser person, a more loving person, and not to philosophically or meditationally self-destruct, not to run away from one's individuality as a person, and to recognize that personal existence is ultimately eternal and actually reflects an infinite personal existence of God. And then the notion of dharma, of principles that we should live our life in a way that's consistent with this understanding. And by taking, if we understand our real existence to be spiritual, and with the generosity of spirit and some common sense, we can understand that every living being is equally spiritual. Our bodies may be different. For example, in America, well, the Spartans, for example, there was a highly militarized society about 2,500 years ago in Sparta, and they were so much into fighting, and they sort of knew, I guess, that men on average, this is science, have like twice the upper body strength as women, so since they wanted warriors, they often would get rid of female babies. I'm certainly not condoning that. They have such bad karma, probably they collapse. But anyway, they would expose or weak male children. If they had male babies that were somehow, you know, weak or damaged, they would just put them on the tops of mountains or something where the, I guess, birds of prey would remove them from the ecosystem. So this idea, and I think we consider it to be a sign of our culture being civilized, that we don't kill human beings because in some way they're physically or mentally, they have some problem, some physical or mental problem. We don't just kill them. And so, why not? I mean, after all, if we look at, say, other mammals like bears or cows or horses or dolphins or whatever, they also have intelligence, they have families, they have emotions, they communicate in certain ways and so on. And so, what is it that convinces us that other feeling creatures have no rights whatsoever? Actually, we're kind of ambivalent about this because, for example, there's a former NFL quarterback who had to give up his multi-million dollar salary and go to jail because he was killing dogs. He was killing dogs. And yet, there are other creatures who are just as evolved or developed as dogs that we kill every day. I mean, they're killed industrially by the thousands and millions. And so, why? I mean, why do we do that? If you think of the worst kind of government, and the worst kind of government, say like typical, like some Hollywood movie, Roman Emperor, decadent Roman Emperor, if he puts his thumb up, you live, thumb down, you die. In other words, you have no rights. In the worst kind of government, you have no rights. You only have rights at the whim of a tyrant. So in that way, there's something decadent and tyrannical about our attitude toward other creatures, non-human creatures. In other words, they have no rights themselves. We happen to like dogs as pets. So therefore, if you kill a dog, you go to jail. If you slaughter other equally developed mammals, that's just dinner. That's just dinner. And so this inconsistent, incoherent attitude is because we, typical of decadent tyrants, and we are tyrannical in our attitude toward other creatures on this earth. We believe that they have rights only if we put our thumb up. You know, like cows don't make good pets nowadays because we mostly live in cities and, you know, you can't really keep a pet cow in your apartment or in your suburban house or whatever. And so it's like if we become attached to an animal as a pet, the animal has rights. If we don't like it as a pet, you can just slaughter it brutally. And so, so another thing which we are teaching is that all creatures actually have rights. And the rights don't come from us. The rights, well, Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence gave an argument that actually our rights in a democratic regime come from God, the Creator. And so that's another thing, part of this understanding here is that we have to be respect and be generous toward all living things. All living things. Because they don't belong to us, they actually belong to their Creator. They don't belong to us, and we can't trifle, we can't brutalize them because someone cares about them. So, these are some basic ideas, which I think are not impossible to understand. Adhikarta here, I introduce. Adhikarta. Adhikarta is a wise sage in his own right, and he will be here. And so those who get a chance to talk to him, he'll explain all kinds of things. Any other question? Yes.
If you could go for another half an hour of discussion, there's
a glitch.
Delay or glitch, technical difficulty.
I was just perhaps on a card, so you could continue. The old soldier. Use it. Go ahead. Come on up. Badahari.
Question.
Yes. Question.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Harold.
I want to thank you for having.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question. I'm writing a column. Effects on the community. And I was curious, you've been talking a lot about government and its role. What do you think is the government's role when it comes to protecting the religion? Could you elaborate on that, please? That might be a
yeah, there is a there's very ancient tradition of protecting religion, going back thousands of years in different parts of the world. And I suppose that question would be part of a larger question, just to put it in context. The larger question would be, what is the purpose of government, or what is the role of government? So I think in America, the basic notion here, the founding of our country, is that governments were constituted in order to pursue the welfare of the people. There's a very interesting part of the Old Testament in, I think at the end of the book of Judges, the judges back then in ancient Israel were not judges in the modern sense. They were the leaders that would rise up at time of need, sort of lead the people into battle or whatever. Because at that time, when according to the Old Testament, when the Jewish people first came from Egypt into Israel, they had a very strong notion that God was their king. And that would distinguish them from other people was that they had no human king. And God was their king. And but as they settled into that land and as a society developed more and grew, it's one thing when you have your like semi-nomadic sort of wandering around, you don't need a king. but when you actually become a settled country. So at the end of the book of Judges, again and again there's a refrain that in those days there was no king and every man did what he wanted. And so they began to see a need more and more to ask a government. So governments are constituted to protect people from each other and to promote human flourishing in various ways and so on. So, yes. Well, can I guys get to religion?
Sure. Yeah.
What's your name?
My name's Paul.
Paul. Thanks. Pleasure. Yeah, pleasure.
You're very wise. I'm enjoying this little lecture.
Thank you. So, thank you very much. So getting to religion. No, please, we're just talking. So getting to religion, most societies in history have concluded that in terms of their flourishing, what is most important is their ultimate spiritual beliefs. In fact, it very much touches upon the material side, because the idea being that if we do flourish, let's say economically, in terms of food and shelter and security, safety from our enemies and so on, that itself is a blessing from the divine. And so therefore, to protect the right of the people to pursue their highest values and to pursue their own salvation, I think is an extremely important right. In fact, this country was founded by people that crossed the ocean in these little toy ships or boats. This country was founded by people that came across the ocean because they thought it was so important to have the freedom to pursue their ultimate salvation according to their conscience. And America was founded as a country in which there was a separation of church and state, which, by the way, was not meant to mean separation of country and God. It was meant, the separation of church and state simply meant that America, unlike all the other countries in the world, would not have a state church. There would not be one church which was the official religion of America. But if you read the Federalist Papers, for example, James Madison's writing, it's very clear that they state very openly that America wouldn't work, this experiment in democracy would not work unless the people are God-conscious. Because only a God-conscious people actually could, because again, if you give people power, they'll, anyway, I won't comment on modern government, but the idea being that people have to vote with conscience, with wisdom, and there's really a need, so they need to be God-conscious. So protecting people's access to and the right to pursue their God-consciousness or their spirituality, however they understand it, I think is one of our most important rights. I think it's the First Amendment, you know, it's in the Bill of Rights. So, and of course, the obvious corollary that if someone claims their religion requires them, let's say, to kill people, everyone else that has another religion, that's, in other words, our freedom to pursue our religion has to be within reasonable boundaries.
You answered all of them. I was going to ask whether you believe in the separation of church and state.
Right.
And, yeah, I think in the context, what you said was that doesn't necessarily mean there's a separation of state and God.
God and country, right, exactly.
That's the answer I'm looking for.
To elaborate, and I have,
yes, please.
You said something about, you know, a lot of I see is fear. You know, we must kill somebody that doesn't worship the way we do. Do you ever see a time when we could have religious education in schools? I mean, obviously you've got it at the university level, but if it were to come down to the children, this is what today religion is about, this is what the Hindu religion is about, this is what the Catholics, so that they could hear all of the different and learn about them, so there's not so much fear in because of the unknown.
Yeah, they do teach it. I know in California, I'm from California, they do a lot of things in California, but they do put it in the school textbooks. The fact is that religion has been perhaps the single most important institution in human history. If you look at moral systems, they have come from a religious context. There really aren't any enduring civilizations in history where just a bunch of bright liberal people got together and said, hey, why don't we enter into a social contract? And that's not really how it happens. And so, yeah, I think children should learn the important role that religion has played in history, and not to fear. I mean, there are some scary things. I mean, religion, certain people in any religion can be scary at times. And so I think part of the fear is that it's interesting. There is a phenomenon called post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And what it means is if a person, a child or an adult, has a very traumatic experience. Typical examples, people come back from combat, that's been a big issue now, the access of American veterans to health care for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Children, for example, that witness something very violent, something really horrible. And so, two of the main symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder are hypervigilance and withdrawal. In other words, if you've gone through a traumatic experience because your whole body is kind of like afraid, you don't want to go through that again, and so there's a type of hypervigilance. You could call it paranoia, but hypervigilance, and then withdrawal, you kind of like back away from things because you're afraid you may repeat that same traumatic experience. So what's interesting is, I would argue, that I am arguing right at this very moment, that our civilization, Western civilization, is suffering at a civilization level, at a societal level, from a type of collective post-traumatic stress disorder. Because I just don't think, in other words, if you walk out the door of your house and you see your neighbor being burned alive at the stake because she was a witch or he was a Protestant or he was a Catholic, or, and this went on all the time. I mean, there was a time in European history not that long ago when some of the cleverest people, I wouldn't say the wisest people, but some of the cleverest people in Europe as a full-time job would try to come up with the most horrible, excruciating, horrific ways to slowly kill other people. And there was a time after Newton published his work that professors in leading European universities were writing pamphlets and articles on how to identify the true witch, because you obviously don't want to burn alive the wrong person. You want to burn alive the right person. So, if you study the 16th century, I mean, go on and on and on. I mean, I think it's absolutely irrefutable, it's undeniable that these were extremely traumatic episodes in history. And as a civilization, when finally these murderous regimes were overthrown, and that's where secular society comes from, as a reaction to these traumas. If you consider hypervigilance, there's a type of hypervigilance on the side of secularism. I'll give you an example of what I consider to be hypervigilance. And this gets into very much like religion and state. There is a philosophical position, not a religious position, a philosophical position which goes back many, many centuries, half a millennium before the birth of Jesus, which is basically, you would call it intelligent design. The idea that the world is designed and created, it didn't just arise spontaneously. These two competing philosophical notions, that the world evolved unaided by any intelligent intervention, or that some type of intelligence designed the world. By the way, intelligent design theory cannot prove the existence of God, it, even if it worked as a philosophy, it simply proves the existence of a designer. But in any case, what's interesting is that throughout the intellectual or philosophical history of Western civilization, going back to the earliest Greek philosophers, you find there were these two views. And yet, there are many people in this country who fight tooth and nail to prevent children's schools from knowing that. In other words, they want to censor the intellectual history of Western civilization. They want to censor it so that children are not told that there actually are two philosophical positions. And in terms of evolution and intelligent design, we have a fossil record. But you see, the fossil record simply says, we found this bone, it appears to be this old. We found that bone, it appears to be that old. If you assemble the bones, it looks like these bones go together and constitute the skeleton of a single creature, and then later we got this skeleton. And so you can produce a timeline compensating for the fact of the unscrupulous handling of the fossil record throughout history, as proved by studies of it. But anyway, taking sort of like the general fossil record, that's all you've got. All you've got is a timeline with different kinds of skeletons. That's all you've got. Now, if you want to get from the fossil record, which you could say is more or less a hard fact of science, if you want to get from the fossil record to a theory such as unaided evolution, you're not engaged in science, you're engaged in philosophy in a real sense. And so throughout history there have been different philosophical interpretations of the world as we experience it. And again, this goes back hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus. So to say that the teaching of intelligent design is an attempt to establish, in violation of the Constitution, to establish a state religion in America is frankly, as someone born in this country, it's a very embarrassing example of the abysmal ignorance of our judiciary, that they know so little about the philosophical history of our civilization. So, but then again, going back to the PTSD thing, I think that's an example of hypervigilance. Go back to post-traumatic stress disorder. The idea being that you have a fanatical religious regime followed by a fanatical secular regime. You know, equal and opposite reactions. And so, in a sense, getting back to your government thing, I think what we really need in America is to get past the traumatic and traumatizing religious fanaticism, which we didn't have so much in this country. We just kind of just dabbled in it in the sense of violent persecution of Mormons and Catholics, but and other things like that. But America's violent persecution of minority religions was just kind of minor league compared to Europe. So we have to get beyond this violent religious fanaticism in the name of government, but then again get past the irrational, fanatical, equal and opposite reaction to that, in the sense of fanatically censoring religious speech. For example, when I was an undergraduate, also centuries ago, I was at Berkeley, California, back in the late 60s actually, on the streets in the middle of all that mayhem. Anyway, so when I was at Berkeley, there was a law in California that at a public university like Berkeley, you could form a club and you could engage in speech that promoted anything in the world except religion. In other words, you could form an atheist club, but not a theist club. You could advocate anything, promote anything, except religion. Now remember, in 1969, the Supreme Court, by the way, overturned that eventually, but I remember in 1969 when I wanted to start a little Krishna club at UC Berkeley. I was a student there. And I went to the office of Dean Shotwell, who was the Dean of Student Affairs. Somehow I still remember him. And I told him I wanted to form a student club. And you know, first thing he said, this isn't religious, is it? Of course, I said, no, it's not. It's philosophical. And so, but it's interesting. I mean, that was an example where religion is singled out as a as the only thing that you cannot promote. And of course, we've come a long way since then, but there's still ways to go. Yeah, it means you're establishing a state church.
But the prohibition of choices is not something you should fear or embrace in a country that laws choices.
Yeah, and the government should, in general, facilitate the spirituality of the people, knowing that a society which is not this way or that way, whatever their religion may be. If people in the society are not somehow or other pursuing spiritual values, then people just degrade into the crassest form of materialism, and it's everybody against everybody in the name of competition. So, I mean, James Madison talked about this in the Federalist Papers. If people become just rampantly selfish, they cheat, they lie, everyone fights for themselves, and basically society disintegrates. So it's in everyone's self-interest that the people in a society, by whatever means, pursue real spiritual values, whatever their religion may be, that they actually pursue, they cultivate virtue. It's just like someone pointed out that after 9/11, some of our political leaders told people that we have to show we're strong, please go out and shop. So, I mean, granted that, you know, we have to keep the economy going and so on and so forth, but it's interesting, even sometimes the notion of the economy has to grow. Even if you get, a president who claims to be a devout believer in a particular faith, in this case, a faith which actually advocates humility, austerity, simplicity. I mean, look at the life of Jesus and his disciples. They were very much like sages, like austere sages living simply. And yet, the very notion that, no, we don't want to just be in a fever of consumption and production, everyone should just have what they need. You see, that's subversive to the economic powers that be. So even if you get a president who claims to be devoutly following a religion which in its original history advocated a simple, humble life, you have this great call to consume. Because if you don't, the president's friends may not make as much as they would otherwise. And so, but where's the call to consume less? That why don't we just take what we need? Why don't we not waste things? Let's not waste. When I was a kid, I was taught not to waste food, not to waste anything. And so, where's the call to live simply? Take just what you need. Don't take more than you need. You know, live comfortably, be happy, but just take what you need. Don't take more than that. Who's advocating that? So the idea that economic health means that more and more people are gouging more and more other people or no. Why can't we define economic health as simply everyone has basically what they need? Not for vanity, not to show off, not to waste, not to flaunt, but just because you, as a human being, you need that in order to be healthy. So, but those kinds of values, in a sense, are spiritual values, because why would you want to live that way unless the real you is not just the consuming body? If the real you is somehow a spiritual being, then it makes sense. Just, you know, take as much as you need to be healthy and comfortable. But don't take more than that, because your real life is not just your body. Your real life is you, the spiritual being within. That's the real you. And so, I mean, Jesus said, pile up your riches in heaven. So, as we all know, you know, it's a big cliche that one earth, limited resources, and maybe like 200 national economies that all have to grow. I mean, think of that. There's hundreds of countries in the world, hundreds of national economies that all have to grow when the earth has already been exhausted, the oceans are exhausted. And so, the real message is, why don't we just take what we need? Like, why don't I build a house which is just big enough so that it's just what I need? So, yeah. So therefore, I think that a society which does not systematically pursue, cultivate, honor spiritual values simply won't survive. I saw this great bumper sticker that said, nature fast last. Nature fast last. So, Pinot baseball. I thought I was the entertainment. Yes.
With emotion.
Oh, one last question. It's your husband.
With emotion of federal notion today that organized religion is evil and then the spiritual, like many people say, and people say that I don't look to organized religion under the spirituality, which is like kind of separating the people. Would it be also that
Yeah, because, I mean, let's say there's some type of epidemic in the land, and there is a medicine for it, an antidote for it. And then someone comes and says, I'm not into organized healthcare. So, you know, if you meet someone and you want to give them the medicine, that's cool. But I'm not into organized healthcare. If you believe you have something of value for other people, wisdom, it seems to me you'd want to distribute it. It's like, why have a university? Why have organized education? Why not everybody just kind of, you know, if you're interested in something, go buy a book on it? Why organize education? Why organize healthcare? Why organize anything which you believe is beneficial? And so the idea that wisdom should not be efficiently distributed, or that somehow there's something about efficiency which is inevitably corrupting, that as soon as you organize something, you corrupt it, that you cannot simultaneously organize something and still preserve it in a pure state. I mean, is that actually true? So, it seems that those are unwarranted or hasty assumptions. And if we study the history of, history, people don't study history, and therefore they tend to think literally in a shallow way, because there's no time depth in their thinking. And so when they say things like that, it's often based on their own immediate experiences rather than a serious study of history and what's actually possible, what has been done. So the more you know about what has actually taken place in the world, the more options you're aware of, the more possibilities there are. And you can see, you know, how things can be done right.
Yes.
So thank you all very much.